The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth today. I will be with you Wednesday and Friday of this week as well, while Seth is touring the Holy Land with Dennis Prager, a place I would really like to be at this moment. Actually, I'd like to be in Israel almost any time. It's a wonderful, wonderful place to visit. And I'm coming to you from Eagan, Minnesota, today. And if I look out the window, I can't do that right now because I'm in a basement studio, but if I look out the window, I see the snow-covered landscape. Minnesota, along with other northern states, has been deluged by unusually early snowstorms this year. So the thought of being in Israel in December right now is sounding really good. Anyway, that's where Seth is. So I'll be with you today as well as tomorrow and Friday. Yesterday, we wound up talking about impeachment for almost the entire three-hour show. We took a little detour with Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, but yesterday's show was basically taken up with impeachment. A lot of news there with the hearing on Wednesday, the panel of law professors who are going to testify to something, goodness knows what, and other things going on that front. And so we didn't get to a lot of other news stories that I kind of had queued up to talk about. And so today we are going to have an impeachment-free Tuesday. I promise there will be no talk about impeachment on today's show. We did that yesterday, and today is impeachment-free Tuesday. If you want to call and be heard on anything we're talking about today, or if you think I'm overlooking today's most important news story and you want to bring it up and talk about it, that's fine, too. Whatever you want to talk about is good. You can call us at 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960 anytime, and we will put you on the air. So, a lot of news today. President Trump is in London for the NATO leaders meeting. We'll talk about that a little bit later. One of today's big news stories, I guess it's a big news story, is that Kamala Harris has dropped out of the race for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And I think, maybe I'm forgetting somebody, but I think Kamala Harris is the first person to drop out who anybody knew was in the race in the first place. I think a couple of others have dropped out, but they're people whose names you probably wouldn't recognize. But Kamala Harris's quitting the race is kind of significant, I think, for several reasons. One, when this whole thing started, however many months ago that was, a lot of people thought that Kamala Harris was one of the favorites to win the Democratic presidential nomination. I actually was one of those pundits. If I'd had to pick somebody in the beginning, it would have been Kamala Harris. I thought she was a very, very strong contender. She checked a number of obvious boxes. I really thought when the process began, she was probably the candidate to beat. You know, the Democrats keep saying they want a woman. She's a woman. They need to lock up 90% of the African American vote, or they can't win. Something not quite 90%, but you know, they have to get an overwhelming majority of the black vote plus huge turnout among African Americans to have a good shot. So I thought that Kamala Harris was a likely nominee. And beyond that, you know, she's quite attractive. She's from California. She, I think, is quite intelligent. And so on paper, she had a lot going for her. So what happened? Why did her campaign never take off? We'll talk about that as we go through the segment. But But maybe a prior question is, why is she dropping out now? You know, what's going on? Why is she giving up? I mean, she's not doing any worse in the polls than a lot of the other candidates. And, of course, there hasn't been any actual voting yet. Not a single vote has been cast. And the answer is she's dropping out because she's out of money. And when she announced her departure from the race, she took a little shot at Michael Bloomberg and maybe Tom Steyer by saying, quote, "I'm not a billionaire. I can't fund my own campaign," close quote. And that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. And that's happened to a number of candidates over the years that some people thought had a lot of promise. But what they didn't have was a lot of money. And if we go back to 2016, for example, a lot of people thought that Scott Walker was a guy who had a decent shot at the Republican nomination that year. I was one of those people. He might have been my first choice. I don't know. I was very impressed with what he'd done in Wisconsin. But Scott Walker was another guy who ran out of money before a single vote had been cast and had to pull out of the race. And it's an interesting thing, you know, because what's mostly going on right now in the in that race is the debates, and the debates are free. I mean, I guess you have to raise a certain amount of money to qualify, at least raise not a certain amount of money, but money from a certain number of people, I think, is their standard, along with a certain standing in the polls. But you know, that's not a big money issue, being in the debates. The issue there is to perform well once you're in them. She was in them. And then the other thing that's big these days at this stage of the race is earned media. So some of these candidates spend a lot of money on consultants. They put money into television, which is very expensive. That's where more campaign money gets burned up than any place else. And they realize at a very early stage of the proceedings, before the voters have had a chance to weigh in, that they're out of dough and they have to drop out. And that's what happened, apparently, to Kamala Harris. And I think it's interesting to compare candidates like her with someone like Rick Santorum. Now, Rick Santorum made two or three quite credible runs for the Republican presidential nomination. I think there was one year when he was the second or third to the last guy standing, and he never had any money. You know, he was kind of a genius at running presidential campaigns without spending any money. And, you know, he didn't hire the expensive Washington consultants. He didn't spend money on television. He ran kind of a guerrilla campaign and did, in terms of bang for the buck, probably did as well as any presidential candidate ever. But the other candidates don't seem inclined to learn from that kind of example. And politics is largely these days about raising money. And so when Kamala Harris realized that she's not raising enough money, and as she says, she's not a billionaire, that was the end of her campaign. And I guess it tells us something about contemporary politics in America. Now, one of the reasons why I thought Kamala Harris would be a strong contender early on is that she's not part of the geriatric brigade. You know, one of the problems the Democrats have is that most of their leading presidential contenders are really elderly. I mean, Joe Biden, enough said, we may talk a little bit more about him later on in the show, but I mean, he's just doddering. And Bernie Sanders has already survived one heart attack during this campaign and is also, you know, elderly and visibly elderly. Elizabeth Warren is only a little bit younger. So I thought that was another reason why Kamala Harris had a good shot, but obviously it didn't do her much good. So what was her problem? Why did she flame out when it seemed like she had a lot going for her? Well, I think what a lot of people would say is that she came across as inauthentic. She flip-flopped on Medicare for All. And once you get the reputation of being a flip-flopper, then, you know, every time you turn around, somebody's accusing you of flip-flopping on something else. And I think if you were going to try to identify some objective factor, some explanation for why she underperformed so badly, that would probably be on the list. Although, you know, frankly, Joe Biden is running against his entire history as a member of the United States Senate. I mean, you know, there's hardly anything that Joe Biden has advocated for or voted for over the last 30 years that he would now stand behind. So it's kind of an epic flip-flop. Maybe when you do it on that scale, it doesn't count. I don't know. We're going to run to some commercials here. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the presidential race on the Democratic side in the wake of Kamala Harris's departure. Welcome back to Impeachment Free Tuesday on the Seth Leibson Show. John Hinderacher from Powerline filling in for Seth today. And I promise nothing in today's show will be about the Democrats' impeachment farce. We covered that yesterday, and today is Impeachment Free Tuesday. Before the break, we were talking about Kamala Harris dropping out of the Democratic presidential race. I don't know if it was unexpected. There have been all kinds of reports of her campaign being in turmoil, staffers quitting, a lot of disorganization, and ultimately she ran out of money. But so where does that leave the Democrats? And I think it just sort of heightens the recognition that they have a serious problem and that they do not have a viable presidential candidate. Who's it going to be? Joe Biden continues to lead the polls, which is fine with me. I'm speaking as a Republican here, but I'm sure that many Democrats are appalled to look at the latest poll and see that Joe Biden, what is he now, 77, I think, is still on top. And there's nobody, as far as I can see, really closing on Slow Joe. And there's a reason why he's been called Slow Joe Biden for a long time. In his best days, he was slow, to be blunt. And that was a long time ago. And when you see him now, it's all he can do to get through a public appearance without embarrassing himself. Some of the latest videos of him going around speaking on the stump as part of this campaign are just embarrassing. They're embarrassing even to describe. And yet, as weak a candidate as Joe Biden is, he continues to lead the pack. For a while, it looked like the race was Elizabeth Warren's to lose. In fact, I said that it's her race to lose. You know, she was closing rapidly and seemed to be occupying the far left lane, as they say, in the Democratic contest. But Warren seems to have crashed and burned over the prohibitive cost of her health care proposal, which she kept talking about. And the more she talked about it, the more she dropped in the polls. She's got some very serious liabilities. I'll just tick off a few of them. One, she's very far left. The idea it might be true that the Democratic Party is ready to go as far left as Elizabeth Warren. It is certainly not true, I think, that the American electorate as a whole is willing to go that far left. Another problem that she's got is the whole fiasco of her alleged Native American heritage. That's kind of faded now. The controversy is over. The facts are now known. You know, 1,024th or whatever it is, might be American Indian. But the fact that she climbed the pole of academia with a big leg up by claiming to be an American Indian, which is how she put it on a form that she filled out at one point that we put up on Powerline. Race or national origin, she wrote in American Indian, which is just unbelievable. Total lie. And I think most people understand how affirmative action works in America. Most people understand that if you can check one of these minority boxes, especially in academia, that gives you a major advantage. And she obviously took full advantage of that. And I think if she were actually the Democrats' presidential nominee, that would come back as a major, major problem. And I think the other problem that she's got is, among others, is that Elizabeth Warren is one of the few women in America who make Hillary Clinton look warm and fuzzy. I mean, I can't imagine that there are a lot of voters who would look forward to the prospect of 4 years of Elizabeth Warren hectoring the rest of us and lecturing the rest of us on television. I don't see it happening. If you want to weigh in, if you disagree or if you agree, give us a call at 602-508-0960. And then, of course, there's the ever-lovable Bernie Sanders, still in mourning over the demise of the USSR, has already suffered a heart attack in the course of the current campaign. His moment, if he had a moment, I think was in 2016, and I don't see him emerging victorious here, although there are still a lot of loyal Bernie bros. I'll give him credit for that. And then you've got some of the newbies. I mean, Pete Buttigieg, for example, the idea that Pete Buttigieg is a viable candidate for the presidency of the United States seems ludicrous to me. I mean, apart from a number of other considerations, his political experience is totally lacking. I mean, this guy is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. It's a pretty big leap from mayor of South Bend to president of the United States, and Pete Buttigieg is not going to make it. And I think the fact that he's getting as much attention as he is testament mostly to what a weak field the Democrats have. And then, of course, we now have Mini Mike, as President Trump has dubbed him, Mini Mike Bloomberg, who has jumped into the race. And I guess he's worth $54 billion. So if an election can be bought, I guess Bloomberg is the one who is in a position to buy it. But I think if there's one thing that we've learned over the years, it is that money doesn't necessarily translate into votes. Still, I can't blame Bloomberg for jumping in. You can imagine him sitting on the sidelines and looking at Mayor Pete rising in the polls to the number three spot or whatever he is, you know, it varies from poll to poll. But you can imagine Mike Bloomberg being on the sidelines and watching that and saying to himself, what the heck? If the mayor of South Bend, Indiana is a viable candidate for the Democratic nomination, why not the mayor of New York? I got a lot more going for me than Pete Buttigieg. So I suspect that's at least part of what drew Mini Mike Bloomberg into the race. But here again, the idea that the elderly, diminutive, super wealthy Mike Bloomberg is going to walk away with this race seems to me to be almost a fantasy. I mean, this guy used to be a Republican, which is not what Democratic Party primary voters are looking for. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by financial planner John Dombrowski. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. We are joined now by financial planner John Dombrowski. John, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Thanks, John.
John, the markets were down today, and I think it's a classic example of the markets reacting to a news headline on a kind of a short-term basis. What happened today?
Yeah, well, we had the president again made some comments regarding the China trade, thinking that it's possible that they may not reach some type of an agreement this year, and possibly not even, you know, before the next election. He actually said that, you know, it's not necessarily the most important thing. You know, he wants to make sure if we're going to have some type of a deal, he wants it to be a good deal for the U.S. He feels China's been taking advantage of the U.S. for many, many years. And if we're going to make changes, he says he doesn't want it to just be a flat, equal deal. He wants it something that's going to really benefit the United States. And I think that's important. And I think if most people were honest about it, they'd want that to be the case as well.
You know, Trump is a tough negotiator. I think part of what's going on is that the Chinese keep watching the impeachment proceedings in the House and looking at polls and
sure.
so on. And they're obviously hoping that Trump loses next year and they get to negotiate with a Democrat. I don't think there's any mystery about that.
And so that's likely true, yeah.
Yeah.
And
so
also,
I think
you have to think of Hong Kong, too, about Hong Kong. I mean, the president came out and basically said, hey, you know, we're for freedom and we back the people of Hong Kong who are fighting for their freedom. And, of course, China's going to be a little bit upset about that. So there's a variety of things that are happening that ultimately we'll see if we're really going to be able to reach some type of an agreement.
So when Trump says, yeah, it may not happen until after the next election, after I get reelected, you know, he's kind of, you know, he's sort of daring the Chinese to try to wait him out. So it's, you know, it's a tough, important negotiation. I know none of us really has a crystal ball, John, but where do you think it's likely to end up? Are we going to see a deal here in the coming months? And if so, how good a deal?
I really don't know if we will. I mean, I've been stating all along when I speak with Seth about this as well, that we're so far apart the way our two countries think, the philosophies, and to really come up with something that's a meaningful trade deal, it's going to be very difficult, and both sides are going to have to give a lot in order to get where I think we need to be. So if it takes a year, if it takes 2 years, I would just hope that if the president gets reelected or when he gets reelected, that China's going to realize they've got to deal with him and that something will get done. They'll bend a little bit more. And as I think the president is really looking out for this country and trying to benefit this country and trying to make sure that he can continue to create jobs and prosperity for the country, which is going to bode well for the stock market. So these short-term blips right now, again, if you're investing in your 401ks and you're investing on a regular basis through your payroll deduction, keep doing that. Buy when the markets are high, buy when the markets are low. That dollar cost averaging is going to pay off in the long run for you once you reach that all-important date of retirement.
John, what are you seeing as good investment opportunities in the markets these days?
You know, I would probably think domestic positions might at the moment be a little bit better for a portfolio than international holdings. So, you know, if someone has a diversified portfolio, oftentimes you'll find a variety of different sectors that they might be holding. They may be holding bonds as well as equities internationally or emerging markets. Those are very common things to do. You may want to take a look again at your current allocation and just see if you're overweighted in those areas, and if so, what should you be doing to make adjustments to make sure that you're, you know, keeping up with what's happened economically. And that's what I do with my clients on a regular basis. If people want me to review their portfolios for them, happy to do that. They could just call my office or go to our website at GrandCanyonPlanning.com.
GrandCanyonPlanning.com. And, John, I think you've got to get in some kind of a notice here at the end of the segment.
Yeah, our disclosure. Thank you, John. Securities and Advisory Services, Office of Client One Securities LLC, member of FINRA and SIPC, and investment advisor, Grand Canyon Planning Associates, LLC, and Client One Securities LLC, and not affiliate. Have a great evening.
Thank you. We'll be right back. I'm into something good. Herman's Hermit's Best, in my opinion. I think that is a classic of popular music, and I'm old enough to remember when it was brand new being played on the radio. Herman's Hermit's I'm Into Something Good, a terrific throwback to the 1960s. There are times when you're a radio host and your producer plays some really terrific bumper music when it's very tempting to just listen to the whole song and put off the start of the next segment. But duty calls. So it's impeachment free Tuesday here on the Seth Leibson Show. We're going to talk about a lot of things. The one thing we're not going to talk about is the Democrats' farcical impeachment effort. And what I want to talk about this segment is some recent manifestations of Trump derangement syndrome. Now, you can't go through 24 hours in the news without seeing multiple instances of Trump derangement syndrome. Some would say that's primarily what the news consists of these days. I think that's probably true. But this morning, well, to back up, yesterday, I guess it was, the White House put out a video of Melania Trump giving a sort of guided tour of the White House as it is now decorated for Christmas. And it's, you know, it's just a nice, feel-good kind of thing. You know, she goes around showing the various rooms, trees, decorations, whatever. And Melania Trump is a lovely woman. You know, whatever you think of Donald, I mean, I don't know what anybody could say negative about Melania Trump. She's an absolutely lovely woman, and I think a real credit to the White House. So the White House put this video out yesterday about this year's White House Christmas decorations, and what was the result? Well, Marco Rubio kind of summed it up in a tweet early this morning. Marco tweeted screenshots of several of the so-called mainstream press's reactions to the White House Christmas decoration video. And Marco tweeted, "Even the White House Christmas decorations trigger deranged criticism. Does anyone in the world of major media have enough self-awareness to realize the damage their hatred of Donald Trump is inflicting on them and on journalism?" I think the answer to that question is no. But what was he talking about? Well, he screenshotted three headlines. The first is from the Washington Post, which, you know, I can remember when the Washington Post was actually, I used to refer to the Post as the most respectable voice of the Democratic Party. Yeah, they were Democrats, but they were, it was a good newspaper. It was a respectable newspaper. Those days are long gone. So the Washington Post headlines, "Melania Trump's Christmas decorations are lovely, but that coat looks ridiculous." That's right. The headline referred to this white coat that Melania Trump was wearing in the Christmas decoration video. That coat looks ridiculous. That's what the Washington Post has to say about it. And the New York Times has a different take because their headline suggests that Melania Trump was absent from the video in a way that was sort of blameworthy. The New York Times headlines, "Melania Trump reveals Christmas decor but stays hidden." She stays hidden in the video. And then People.com, People Magazine, they've got a piece on the White House Christmas decorations video. And they hearken back to last year's Christmas decorations, not this year's, but last year's, which apparently they didn't like. And People headlines, "Melania Trump debuts new White House Christmas decorations after last year's memeable blood red decor." So they can't think of anything bad to say about this year's White House Christmas. And so they hearken back to what they didn't like about last year's White House Christmas decorations. Now, if you think back to how the press treated Michelle Obama, which was, I mean, it was embarrassing. I'm one of those people who believe that the president's family is basically off limits. And it's just stupid to attack first ladies, you know, or president's children. I mean, come on, give me a break. I think I can say with confidence that never in 8 years did I say a bad word about Michelle Obama. I don't think I said a word about her, period, or not many anyway. And in general, she was treated by the press not only with kid gloves, which I think is fine, but as though she were some kind of a saint and a savant, you know, at the same time. And she was neither. You know, she's Barack's wife. You know, what the heck? But in any event, never was there a harsh word said about her, a critical word said about her in the press over 8 years. And you contrast that with the way that the press treats Melania Trump, and it's kind of embarrassing. And I think Marco Rubio was exactly right when he tweeted this morning, "Even the White House Christmas decorations triggered deranged criticism. Does anyone in the world of major media have enough self-awareness to realize the damage that their hatred of Donald Trump is inflicting on them and on journalism? I think the answer to that question is no. Either they don't know or they don't care. It's sometimes hard to tell which. But no, I don't think they understand how they are damaging themselves far more than they're damaging President Trump. You look at any of the polls on people's regard for the press, regard for the media, and it's in the toilet. I mean, it's been bad for a long time, but it is worse than ever. It's much worse than ever. And the number of people who take seriously the idea that news outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post are fair, are objective, are trustworthy, are reliable, are truthful. I mean, it's dwindled down to a hard core of Democrats who probably don't seriously believe that those outlets are fair or objective or reliable. They just don't care. You know, they're Democrats and they applaud the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, you name it, for being on their side, for being on their team. But even among Democrats, polls increasingly show a lack of confidence, a lack of respect for what used to be termed the mainstream media, which I now usually refer to as the Democratic Party media. I think that's essentially what they are. They have pretty much dropped the mask. They've dropped the pretense. And it's almost funny to watch the frustration that they so often manifest. They can't understand why their ceaseless attacks on President Trump, attacks on conservatives, attacks on Republicans aren't more effective. How can it be that there's a danger of President Trump actually being reelected when they've been attacking him nonstop 24/7 since before he was even inaugurated? They still can't figure out why it is that nobody is listening to their outpourings of hate. We will be back after these messages. Welcome back to the program. Before the break, we were talking about Trump derangement syndrome as manifested in the press. I want to toss out another example. This comes from the world of psychiatry. This is a headline that I wrote about on Powerline yesterday. The headline is, "Psychiatrists Organize Campaign to Declare Trump, Quote, Dangerous, Close Quote." Psychiatrists. Well, okay, let's learn more. Here's the article. Psychiatrists with the World Mental Health Coalition. And by the way, I think that's just a group that these three psychiatrists named themselves, the World Mental Health Coalition, are soliciting signatures in a campaign to support the impeachment of President Donald Trump, predicated on claims that he is mentally unstable. Right. So who are these psychiatrists? In an email forwarded to PJ Media, three psychiatrists with the coalition ask other psychiatrists to sign on to a petition to the House Judiciary Committee to include a statement on Trump's supposed mental instability in the official record of the impeachment inquiry. Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist at Yale School of Medicine, Dr. Gerald Post, a psychiatrist and political psychologist, who founded the CIA's Center for Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior, and Dr. John Zinner, a clinical professor in the psychiatry department of the George Washington University School of Medicine, wrote the petition and statement condemning Trump. And you know, they say that Trump is unstable. And what's interesting about that is that Trump has consistently pursued coherent policies in both domestic and foreign policy since the day he was inaugurated. That we've rarely had a more consistent or more intellectually coherent in terms of policy president than Donald Trump. Where exactly is the instability? And they say Trump is dangerous, but, you know, his critics can't make up their minds. Is Trump a warmonger? You know, sometimes they say he's a warmonger. But then he pulls out American troops and they criticize him for that. And then they say he's a stooge of Putin. Well, wait, that's the opposite of being a warmonger. It's not true. In fact, it's the opposite of the truth. But they can't even come up with a consistent theory as to what's wrong with him. And if Trump is unstable and dangerous, why is it that his administration has ushered in unprecedented levels of employment and income, and especially benefited minority populations while maintaining peace abroad? I mean, if this is unstable, unstable is what we need more of. We're going to run to a break, and we will be back with more on the Seth Leibson Show.